Support for the Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the Morning Show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD-HD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm really glad to welcome back into our studios Dr. Art Sear, who is director of the Clausen Center at Carthage College, a Clausen Distinguished Professor of World Business and Political Economy, author of After the Cold War, a syndicated columnist, his columns appearing in newspapers across the country, and he is a visitor to the Morning Show once a month, where he offers his analysis of current events both here and around the world. Professor Sear, we welcome you back to the Morning Show.
Well, thank you, Greg, and let me also take the opportunity before we commence to thank you again for having our good colleague Mark Miller on your program. He's a Vietnam, as you know, and many of your listeners know, he's a Vietnam veteran, a combat infantryman in the U.S. Army, served in the latter stages of the war. His memoir, My Vietnam Confessions, has been well-received and is doing well on Amazon. His interview at WUWM appeared, was broadcast on Friday. He's part of a larger effort we've been pursuing long-term at the Clausen Center to do more concerning military service, defense, and veterans issues.
It was good to talk to him. I'm glad we had that opportunity. I'm glad you made the suggestion. So we have a lot to talk about today, of course, but way at the top of the list is a certain presidential election that took place just over a week ago.
Yes.
And of course, if I understand correctly, the votes are still being counted, but there is no question but that we have a victory by Donald Trump in terms of the electoral count. That last count, I believe, 290 to 232. But as, of course, many people know, it was a case in which the popular vote actually went the other way. And the latest numbers I saw showed Hillary Clinton with almost a 1 million vote plurality over Donald Trump. So it was certainly not an unprecedented case where the electoral count, which is what really counts, goes the one way.
You're referring to the Electoral College.
Right. Yeah. And so the one vote went the one way, but the popular vote went the other way. And actually, it's happened fairly recently and a couple of other times in our history. One of the first things we should talk about is the fact that nearly every poll got this wrong, in the sense that, I mean, nobody was predicting any kind of a Hillary Clinton landslide, but certainly the vast majority of polls showed her a little bit ahead of Donald Trump, and every article I read thought that, if anything, the Electoral College count would be more emphatically in her favor than the popular vote, and it just proved to be utterly wrong. I mean, again and again and again, pollsters and pundits seem to have not seen this coming. I want to talk, first of all, just sort of the element of surprise in this particular election and the results. Why do you think it was that so many people ended up being so surprised by this result?
Well, I think bluntly, a lot of the most prominent and powerful media and commentators, including public broadcasting, were populated by people who were personally in favor of a Clinton victory, especially over an unattractive candidate like Trump. I do believe that. More objectively and quantitatively, the polls had a fair amount of diffusion, which in hindsight, which is always 2020, was a warning sign. There was one poll which got it right and has gotten the last few elections right, the Investor's Business Daily. They say they are neutral in business and they have a kind of Chamber of Commerce point of view. In my opinion, they do not, as far as I know, unless they've changed recently, publish letters to the editor, which I think is always a bad sign. And they have a strong conservative bias and they're a lot less interesting than the Wall Street Journal. However, their polling operation has been spot on, including this time. IBD, I think TIPP is the moniker they use, and obviously they're worth following. Like investment funds nowadays, most polls have a good track record for a while, sometimes a long time, like Gallup, and then they fall off. All of that indicates the main point, which is our electorate is very changeable, very volatile currently. And also, we no longer have landlines. When Gallup first started, you could go door to door and the House and find a statistically valid random sample fairly easily from the election rolls, and census information even better. The housewife would be relieved that it wasn't the dreaded door-to-door salesman, and whoever was home would answer the questions, and you could go back for a follow-up. It's been many years, thanks to the cost of human labor nowadays, it's been many years since that approach was used. Gallup gave it up long ago, thanks to the monopoly known as AT&T, primarily. It used to be, and people had only landlines, you used to be able to call, but more and more people use cell phones, more and more people don't. Simply don't answer the phone or let their answering machine take care of it, since we get so many junk calls nowadays. I do believe there is a population of Trump voters who don't normally vote and who probably made a point of not answering telephone surveys or not telling the truth because the system is rigged. Again, that's my opinion. But the objective fact is it's harder and harder to take polls. I think that's the most important reason. The electorate was volatile. Another factor is turnout. As usual, I'm going on perhaps too long, but another very important point is motivating voters is extremely important. The greatest politicians in our system motivate voters, and Hillary Clinton, in great contrast to her husband, did not motivate voters beyond her activist base. Donald Trump did, for better or worse, or both, or neither. A real wild card as a president, isn't he?
Yeah. A lot has been said in recent days in the wake of this election about what a poor campaign Hillary Clinton and the Democrats ran this time around. And, of course, as the campaign was being waged, I don't remember reading very much about that. So that's probably another one of those cases of hindsight.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
2020.
But, absolutely. Yeah. The winner is celebrated and the loser takes,
takes the lumps.
But the heat, the blame.
Right. You look back, however, as you look back at this campaign, do you think can we point to specific strategic mistakes, perhaps, that Mrs. Clinton and her advisors made in terms of how they waged this campaign, where they went, what they said? I mean, what might have made the difference and thrown this in the other direction, do you think?
Well, in the interest of being helpful, everybody's to a degree, piling on now. That always happens, and it's probably even more the case in a surprising election. I have felt for some time that getting down on Trump's level was a mistake. And, the lowest common denominator, the easiest out, losing your temper, that's always the easy way, short term, not long term. I was stunned and very depressed by the fact that all these Republican candidates, we had about 15 of them initially, very quickly went down to his level, personal insult, personal invective, with the exception of Jeb Bush and a couple of others, but it became a very childish insult fest. And he became more and more crude and ghastly, talking about what's inside his pants and, one insult after another, including against the people on the stage with him. He personally maligned, viciously insulted, and by so doing insulted all of us, a very distinguished war veteran, whatever you think of his and former POW in Vietnam, John McCain. At that point, I happened to be watching it at the time. I made up my mind I was not going to vote for Donald Trump, whatever happened. It was just unforgivable and beyond the bounds, and no one, not one of those patriotic, in quotes, Republicans on the stage, called him on it. It was just terrible. At least during the primary season, the Democrats had a more elevated debate. I do think getting down on his level in the general campaign and trying to out-Trump Trump I think the Hillary Clinton people made a mistake, and she made a mistake. And I did feel that way throughout the election. Mm-hmm. I think if she'd taken the high road, it would have been better. And that's not just some professor talking. When you look back to earlier presidential campaigns, I think to a remarkable degree that's been true.
Mm-hmm. One of the interesting things to look at in terms of the numbers, in terms of who voted for Mr. Trump, who voted for Mrs. Clinton, there is a clear indication in terms of male voters across the country. The latest numbers I've seen, 53% voted for Mr. Trump, 41% voted for Mrs. Clinton. Women across the country, 54% voted for Mrs. Clinton, and 54 voted for Mrs. Clinton, 42% voted for Donald Trump. Maybe those aren't particularly surprising factors.
Well, not nowadays, because the gender gap is so much emphasized. Excuse me for interrupting, mm-hmm. but you make a very important point I'd like to reinforce. It's yeah. so much emphasized, and it should be. Excuse me.
Yeah, that's fine. What was striking to me was looking at numbers in terms of ages and the fact that when you look at the four age groups, 18 to 29, 55% voted for Clinton, 37 for Trump. Age 30 to 44, 50% voted for Clinton, 42% voted for Donald Trump. 45 to 65, it swings the other way. Trump 53, Clinton 44. And
that's the population at large.
Right.
Yep.
And similar numbers for 65 and older. So it's a very striking split that I don't think we talk quite as much about between younger voters and older voters. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting to try to sort out what that means. And, for instance, what that even means for the Republican Party, for good as they have to be feeling at the moment, I should think those are disconcerting numbers for them.
There are not just academic analysts, but people who run polls for a living are always careful to say there's more than one factor in play. Turnout was very high among young people who tend to have low turnout was very high for Barack Obama, just as it was among African Americans and Hispanics and others. I believe younger voter turnout was pretty low this time. You should take a variety of variables into account, but you're right, it's important that it was a dramatic age differentiation. It's only been in the last half century that the gender gap has become really important. I did get some valuable experience working at the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations for 2 decades, one of our most successful enterprises, which our President John Riley seized on and which came to the Council from Secretary of State Henry Kissinger. So we always thanked him and continue to do so, was a survey of U.S. public opinion attitudes on foreign policy. It was quite a good education for me. Until the late 60s, men and women, I used to imagine a school of fish swimming together. Men and women tended to vote very much alike. Women were slightly more Republican, believe it or not, but when you controlled for sex, gender, they were very similar. Women were more conservative, a very traditional image, isn't it? From the late 60s, things started to change dramatically, and male and female behavior has changed. It's not just that women tend to be more democratic. While there's been a long-term slow-motion drift of white males to the Republican Party, whether an individual men also tend to vote or not vote, they're very predictable, very boring, aren't we, guys? Absolutely. Women, whether an individual woman voter will vote or not vote from one election to the next, and vote Republican, Democratic, or something else, is very hard to predict because it changes. Let me say with emphasis, I'm saying nothing beyond voting behavior and not generalizing about a gender or anyone else, but in terms of pure voting behavior, it means that women are much more variable and therefore have become the largest and, in consequence, most influential voting bloc in the country. The George W. Bush campaign was very happy. Karl Rove was beside himself when in 2004 they not only managed to get a bare majority of the popular vote for the first time, they had like this last time in 2000, they had a minority. They're about 500,000 behind. But they also got just over 50% of women voters. It was a huge plus for them. Among this extremely important population, I have been paying some attention to this. There were some notable factors this time. A majority of married women voted for Hillary Clinton. However, 52% of white women voted for Donald Trump. He didn't win the popular vote, but he did as well as he did because he drew, for a contemporary Republican, he drew, rather ironically from my point of view, a majority of white women. Non-white women tend to vote much more heavily and reliably Democratic. So it's that white female population that's extremely important, and I dare say the suburbs, where the population remains concentrated despite an important move back to the city, that's where people concentrate their efforts. The importance of the suburbs, I think, has also been continuous over the last half century. John F. Kennedy got a plurality in the suburbs in 1960. Bill Clinton got a majority in the suburbs in 1992. A subtext of that is the important variability of female voters today. It's a really important point, and you obviously can't sum it up in a soundbite, but those are movements that strike me as very important.
Right. Another big surprise this time around, although something was written about this even ahead of the election itself, so in some ways it maybe should not have been as big a surprise as it turned out to be, is the fact that that Mrs. Clinton was going after a coalition roughly formed by Barack Obama that was not the same coalition that would traditionally have powered Democrats into the White House, that it was a coalition made up more of what, let's say, what some people would call the elites of our society, more highly educated folk and so on, versus working class people, union people and so on, which once upon a time was kind of the core of the kind of Democratic power base. And of course, an indication of that is the fact that of that shift is the fact that for years and years and years and years, a place like Kenosha County, would have swept very solidly Democratic in any presidential race. And this time, Kenosha County and Racine County went for Donald Trump. So is this...
And Wisconsin went for Trump. It's the first time a Republican has taken Wisconsin at the presidential level, I believe, since 1984.
Right. Of course, but of course, much of Wisconsin is rural Wisconsin. And I think what was really shocking to people is the fact that even places like Kenosha County, Racine County, which have been thought of as unbreakable bonds to the Democratic Party, went for Mr. Trump. What do the Democrats do about that? Do they need to go back to this historic base and try to recapture them?
Well, you're right. The decline of the industrial unions, the AFL-CIO, in the 1950s and through the 60s and before, starting especially with the New Deal, they were part of the traditional modern Democratic Party coalition. Unionized labor during that era was more than 50% of the U.S. workforce overall. The union membership is now down to less than 30%, and the growth is in hotel workers, teachers' union, and the Democrats do pay a lot of attention to those groups. But I believe you're right in terms of tone and style, in particular the terrible gaffe of referring to Trump voters as the deplorables and other rather disdainful comments, and the incredibly stupid habit of the Clinton people to put all kinds of personal opinion and disdainful comments about one another in emails, which were leaked just before the election, but also a sense of superiority and elitism, I believe, came through. You're right. I tell students, I tell everyone else, and I remind myself, your email is public information. In fact, your telephone calls are public information. There is no such thing as a secure phone. Since the 1950s, the NSA has been able to listen to, monitor just about anything they want to. And the fact that these high-powered, supposedly sophisticated Washington operatives would be so candid in email, to me, was truly unbelievable. I'm obviously naive, but they were really dumb. And I hope there's more restraint in the future. Joseph Kennedy, a very significant political leader, constantly reminded his sons, if it's adults and his the very few people he worked with and trusted on a continuing basis, don't put it in writing. If it's sensitive, boys, don't put it in writing. If it'll embarrass you, if it'll come back to hurt you, if it'll come back to kill you professionally, don't put it in writing. It's good that his papers have been open to the public. More, at least one very naive biography of Mr. Kennedy Sr. has relied on his papers and used that as evidence that things he's been accused of, in fact, did not happen. Don't put it in writing. I think that's good advice for all of us, even if we're not in politics.
Right.
When it comes to very sensitive and personal matters.
Right, right.
I hope that's a coherent answer, because the arrogance of the Clinton campaign was a big factor, and I felt that at the time. I'm not praising Trump, but ignoring working people, in effect, they're simply not part of our calculation, a big mistake. I do think the Republicans have an opportunity. The Teamsters Union, since the 60s and the Kennedy brothers, and particularly the intense and bitter, it went beyond rivalry, the kind of blood feud, quite literally, between Jimmy Hoffa, the notorious head of the Teamsters Union, and the Kennedys, especially Attorney General Robert Kennedy, starting in these almost scary interchanges, which are readily available nowadays, when Bobby was the Rackets Committee Counsel, long before he was Attorney General. Since that time, the Teamsters have been reliable Republicans institutionally, in practical terms. Richard Nixon did a lot to cultivate the Teamsters Union. Trump vows to abandon NAFTA. I hope he doesn't. But it shows the importance of transportation, and the Teamsters remains probably the largest industrial blue-collar union in the U.S. I think there are lots of opportunities for the Republicans, if they're smart, to take advantage of this Democratic failure that you're quite right to highlight.
And the
Teamsters Union, excuse me, sorry for giving a lecture, but the current head, James Hoffa, of a basically honest and law-abiding Teamsters Union, is a very intelligent, very articulate leader. Jimmy Hoffa, whatever his significant failures and faults and crimes, he was a very good father. The son has done extremely well following in his footsteps. The daughter is a respected judge, I think, in Michigan. The Teamsters are worth paying a lot of attention to nowadays, especially because they're never mentioned.
Of course, it was not just Mr. Trump who was victorious last Tuesday night, but also the Republican Party overall.
Yeah, they had their cake and eat it too.
Yeah,
They're absolutely right.
So they gained on Capitol Hill, and they gained in terms of governorships and in state assemblies across the country. I mean, it was just a really, really big day for the Republicans. And, of course, many writers and prognosticators.
They held their majorities in the Senate and House,
right,
is what you're emphasizing.
Right. And of course, again, what not only did a whole lot of people predict a victory for Mrs. Clinton, but also predicted that sort of the divisiveness that had been sown by Donald Trump within the Republican Party. I mean, there are all kinds of high-level Republicans who had come out against Donald Trump vociferously. So the assumption was that it was going to be really difficult for the Republican Party overall to do well within that kind of a chaotic scenario. And, of course, just the opposite happened. It was a very, very good night for the Republicans, given the fact that, I mean, certainly there are, our country is faced with all kinds of problems, but President Obama has had actually some of the highest approval ratings of his entire presidency as of late. So what do you think is fueling this, in a sense, repudiation of Mr. Obama and this assertion of even more power by the Republicans? What do you think is fueling that more than anything?
The Republicans long term, you're right, the president has maintained steadily approval ratings of over 50%, which is a major accomplishment. Nowadays, he's personally likable. He comes across very well on television. He's a brilliant campaigner. At the same time, throughout the Obama era, There's been tremendous steady growth of Republican strength in state houses, state legislatures, governorships around the country. The off-year elections, the Obama elections, 2008, 2012, were extremely successful for the president and his party. But they got clobbered in 2010 and again in 2014. So the long-term grassroots growth has been for the Republican Party. Normally, the victorious party, again, the Democrats actually took the popular vote. But the victorious party at the presidential level most of the time tends to pick up something at the congressional level over the long term. There are exceptions. John Kennedy in 1960 in a dead heat election, the Republicans still gained a few, the Democrats still gained a few. The fact that people are moving away from parties generally, and the really steadily growing percentage in the declared electorate is independents, means it's probably easier to have this kind of anomaly today and in the future. But the president's strength, such as it is, has been limited to him. That's clear throughout his 8 years in office. When you look at the long-term growth of the Republicans at the state level and also in off-year elections in Congress. Hmm. That's another very important point.
Well, we have before us, of course, the prospect now of President-elect Donald Trump becoming President Trump. And, of course, there's all kinds of speculation about what this is going to mean. What have your impressions been thus far in terms of what we have to go on, which is in part the statements Donald Trump has made, beginning with his victory speech on election night, but also what he has said and the appointments that he's made. Of course, most notably, Reince Priebus and Steve Bannon to two of the most significant posts within the White House. What is your sense of the at least early indications of what a Trump presidency is going to look like?
Well, the two gentlemen you mentioned indicated a dual approach so far. I certainly am, and I am so humble nowadays. I tell you, it's hard to believe I'm a professor, but I was so wrong in thinking about how the election campaign would unfold. I don't want your good listeners to turn off their radios, but I'm very cautious about it, predicting anything in the future. Trump is a very unpredictable person. He's certainly by no means an executive. He's primarily a show business personality and one who's done very, very well. He's been anything but a conservative in terms of both his personal style over many years and also his views. The Clintons attended his most recent wedding. That's gotten a lot of publicity. He's had Democratic associations. He's certainly not a social conservative. Priebus represents the Republican establishment, as the media currently uses the term. He's from Wisconsin, which is a plus for this state in the future, and he represents kind of the permanent administration of the Republican Party. Bannon, I don't know much about. He's a behind-the-scenes operator. He's a principal at Breitbart, a right-wing advocacy organization that's taking all kinds of fire, mostly frustrated fire, from the Democrats and much of the media. It kind of represents sort of the two faces so far of the unfolding Trump administration.
Mm. Well, speaking of that sort of divided approach, we probably really need to talk for a moment about...
But nobody knows either. Excuse me. Right. One of our good IPE students, Ms. Wickstead... it's a difficult major. It draws good students, therefore I'm lucky. In the current intro class, I was asking about the election and the polls, and she said, "We don't know. I don't know." And she was absolutely right.
That divided approach of the Trump administration that you just highlighted, that is sort of personified by this, these two different approaches, these appointments.
Our new leader.
Right. Also brings to mind a division of a different sort, and the fact that I think for a lot of people reeling from the results of last week, I mean, people for whom this election was not only a shocking surprise, but also kind of a terrifying one. I mean, for them, it signals the country going in a direction that they don't want it to go, in contrast to everybody who voted for Mr. Trump and wants to see this through. A lot has been written about how sharply divided our country is at this moment, and maybe a division that has always been there, but we didn't realize was there. And a lot has been written about, you know, has Mr. Trump caused this sense of division, or is this a division that is just suddenly made evident? Have we always been this sharply divided, and have always there been these racial issues beneath the surface that now are in the forefront in the wake of this election? What do you make of just our nation as a whole and the sense of divisiveness that we see? I think one of the things you're going to say is that this is not as unprecedented as we might assume it to be.
Well, I don't want to be argumentative, but you should think about what you mean by have we always had racial issues beneath the surface. Race historically has been an extremely difficult issue in this country, starting with the founders. It's always there. I don't have to remind you or anybody listening that we're completing two terms of an African-American president in the White House. At first, it's an important reason why I voted for him, and I'm glad I did. There's nothing beneath the surface about race issues, and in fact, race relations in this country are a great deal better than they were even a few decades ago. Earlier in my lifetime, we had tremendous violence. One of the three horrifying political assassinations as recently in the 60s was Dr. Martin Luther King. You know that. These things are not beneath the surface. They've always been there, and in many ways, things are getting better. So you're right about that. I do think things are getting better, but that's not because it's me, sir. That's because that's the case.
Right. But what I'm saying is there's a whole lot of people who feel exactly the opposite at the moment, who feel like the fact that Mr. Trump was elected indicates a wide swath of the population that is comfortable with certain and again, this is it's tricky to talk about because it's easy to paint with too broad a brush here and to call a whole swath of people racist for voting for a particular candidate. And
yeah, that's, you know, wrong. That's you're wrong.
Absolutely, I absolutely agree.
Just because people in the media say it and encourage fears that right. have a lot more to do with corporate profits and organizational survival than they do with reality. The news is no longer the news.
Sure.
I know that, and I think you do too. That doesn't mean things are actually getting worse in this country. Turn off the television. Turn off the radio for a while. Not the morning show, of course, but is your daily life really that horrible?
Right.
Do we have mass riots in the streets, mass widespread violence and killing, a huge murder rate, an ongoing long-term violent crime rate as we had starting in the 50s and going into the 70s? No, we don't.
Right. On the other hand, we have thousands of demonstrators in the streets at the moment. I mean, in the wake of this election, there's a fairly significant uptick in hate crimes, assaults on various minorities. I mean, ugly racial slurs being painted on walls and so on. And what I'm
not sure there is an increase in violent crime. And I don't think, I'm not defending Trump, and I'm sure as hell not defending racism, but don't leap to the conclusion that every swastika, every racist symbol that's painted on a wall is necessarily painted by a racist or a Trump supporter.
Right.
He's a demagogue. He's irresponsible. I hate to sound like I'm defending him, but he did not make explicit racist appeals in this campaign. Sure, right. Race was there. You'd be naive if you thought it wasn't. It was there especially in 2008 and 2012. But we're not in the midst of anarchy or a violent crime wave, and I feel the need to speak strongly only because so much of the media, for reasons that have nothing to do with actual reality, are busy fear-mongering.
Exactly. Well, that's
thank you for agreeing with me.
Well, well, that's what I guess that's what I'm getting at in posing the question. And I guess what some people would say is that a certain swath of the population has grown complacent and maybe jumped to conclusions about where we are in terms of race. I mean, I think it's a delicate balance between, yes, things are a lot better than they were with fire hoses in the 60s and worse than that.
And yet, gunfire,
yes,
not just fire.
And yet, on the other hand, it's clear that there is a great deal of work yet to do,
of course,
to pull this country together. And the question is, how is that going to look? How is that going to be possible in a President Trump presidency?
Well, I think one thing that might be helpful, I don't think political leaders cause great sea changes. Successful politicians are catalysts for public sentiment, especially in a representative system like ours. And clearly Trump saw and deserves credit for seeing. It led him to the White House. Quite amazing to me. But he saw currents and exploited those. And I'll be pleasantly surprised if he turns out to be a unifying president.
One of the concerns I know that you have is around some of the statements that that Mr. Trump has made about things like NAFTA, things like our relationship to NATO, our willingness to abide by the Paris Climate Accord. What is your sense of what dramatic changes might be afoot, and if Donald Trump himself personally feels holds these sort of views about, for instance, NATO or NAFTA and other international agreements, is there much that stands in his way in terms of him getting his way when it comes to those matters?
Well, yes and no, a good academic answer, or at least a typical one. He can abrogate treaties very, very easily. He can also get rid of executive agreements, which unfortunately is the way that, except for the Affordable Care Act, President Obama governed. He did not care to deal with Congress. That's undeniable at this point, and perhaps had no capacity to move legislation. He did not have a lot of political or legislative experience before he moved rapidly to the White House. Therefore, and I'm sure the Republicans are anxious to do this, they can very quickly get rid of, unlike a law, executive agreements. I think at least parts of the Affordable Care Act are here to stay. I think it was a great accomplishment because this country has a moral obligation to provide medical care universally, and tens of millions of people who previously had no access to regular medical care have gotten it under the Affordable Care Act. That's a great accomplishment. I don't think it's going to be abolished, and Trump has talked about maintaining popular aspects of that law. There are very powerful corporate interests that want NAFTA to continue, and there are very powerful military as well as industrial and informed foreign policy interests that want our treaty obligations to continue. Therefore, I think the steady growth of foreign investment and movement of capital, including into the United States, the world's most popular magnet for foreign investment, and investment outside of the U.S., which to a remarkable degree is dominated by corporations that are largely U.S. in terms of stock ownership or leadership, that will continue even if NAFTA is abrogated. I think the TPP was dead politically, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, before this election. If worse comes to worse, and it could happen if the president goes, meaning Trump, goes berserk and becomes irresponsible in using force, he will be impeached or he will be removed from office, which can be done constitutionally, or the military will refuse to obey the orders. That's what's really important when it comes to being president of the United States and a responsible American citizen observing all this. I don't think he will be able to start a conflagration or a general war or irresponsibly use military force. One of the most positive developments since Vietnam, in my view, has been the tremendous growth in professionalism and consciousness of the importance of law, what's lawful and unlawful in terms of military orders. I hear that directly from senior military people in my current work and other military people in a way that was not the case earlier. I do want to be reassuring, since if not antagonized, I'm sure that a lot of your regular listeners are disturbed by some of the things we've been talking about. If not antagonized by things I've said, I hope this is... I'm sure people are disturbed, and I hope this overcomes some of that about what most important, life and death. That's what's most important.
Right. I think for a given voter who is, whether it's for good reason or not, is sort of terrified by the prospect of a Donald Trump presidency, what has sometimes brought up as a sort of source of reassurance is the fact that our government is set up in a matrix of checks and balances.
Exactly, including the Electoral College. which if you want me to be really boring, we can talk about sometime, not today. Well, actually, but there is no nuclear button on the desk of the president, even though Lyndon Johnson liked to talk that way fairly regularly. And it's important to keep in mind we suffered a major strategic defeat in Vietnam without using nuclear weapons. It was not seriously discussed after Eisenhower vetoed that option way back in the 1950s when the French were going down to defeat in Southeast Asia.
Right.
That should be most reassuring, no matter how vexed any listener might be.
Right. And the other thing that, in terms of just returning for a moment to the image of a sharply divided America, is that your most recent column pointed to the fact that our country has experienced very, very sharp division before, and also political tumult before. So
every 50 years or so. But I don't want to minimize the rather rigid division that's unfolded, starting with the election of 2000. There's not much give between the parties. A tremendous event or a very effective leader can change that. In 1964, after Barry Goldwater was overwhelmed by LBJ, the Republican Party suffered big losses at every level. There were a lot of predictions that the Republicans were about to disappear. 4 years later, Richard Nixon won. He barely won, but he won a remarkable political comeback. And except for Jimmy Carter's election, the Republicans won in 72 and 80, 84, 88. So predictions of the demise of the Democratic Party, all those many Democrats who listened to the morning show, greatly exaggerated. Republicans aren't going to go away, and we don't have a big third party as we did in 48 and 68.
Well, in the closing minutes of our program, let's talk briefly about
the rest of the world.
Two matters. Yeah, right. Yeah, something like that. You mentioned the fact that China has made some interesting moves in regards to Hong Kong. Just summarize what that's about.
Ah, yes. Next week's column, I hope, will deal with the big crackdown in Hong Kong. There was a legislative election. Two young independence advocates, radicals, put on a big demonstration when they took their, and before, but when they took the oath of office, they changed the formal language of the formal oath to advocate independence for Hong Kong. The communist authorities in Beijing went nuts and used that. They did need a fig leaf excuse. That's a change from the Cold War and earlier communism, but they used that to oust these two young people, which I think was a gigantic mistake. They should have just ignored it, but it's led to ongoing demonstrations and a lot of violence in Hong Kong. We were speaking about urban unrest and violence before. It's going on in Hong Kong, and there's a lot of fear that this might be the end of any independence for Hong Kong.
Wow.
I hope that's not the case, and it's probably not, but we've been so preoccupied with ourselves, I must say. Thank you for bringing up the rest of the world. There's a lot of important things going on elsewhere.
Right. Well, and I have a very close relative who was just in Hong Kong, but I think 3 weeks ago. I'm glad he missed all of the this kind of excitement, which would have been, I think, scary to be there. You also should say a word about what's going on in Korea right now and kind of a controversy that is enveloping President Park.
Yes, she has descended into great controversy and great unpopularity very quickly, given an unfolding scandal concerning allegations. Nothing proved in court yet, but allegations of widespread corruption involving her administration. She has deferred to Parliament in letting the legislature appoint her prime minister. Perhaps not unprecedented, but unusual in modern Korea. And she may leave office before the end of her term. South Korean politics tends to be tumultuous, and there have been financial scandals and spy scandals. But this greatly limits South Korea's ability to operate in foreign policy or domestic government policy as well at a time when North Korea is becoming much more nuclear capable. They're always raving and screaming publicly. But it is unfortunate that South Korea is institutionally weaker. On a more positive note, if I may, speaking of female important international leaders, the Prime Minister of Great Britain, Theresa May, has gone out of her way to request an appointment with our new president, and the media, much of it, with the ongoing soap opera they develop, say this is because she is afraid, she is fearful, who knows what this madman will do. And what it really is we have a very, very powerful institutionalized relationship with Britain. They are singularly influential in our foreign policy and have been since World War II, as I like to expound on here. I think that's a very positive sign, and she is in a very strong position to broker good sense between the new administration and our very important and powerful allies in Europe, and perhaps even a reconciliation with Mr. Putin and Russia. There's no need for a new Cold War, and I think perhaps, I certainly hope that Trump's positive sounds about Putin and Russia might lead to some useful foreign policy cooperation in the interest of this country.
Very interesting.
Well, I hope so. Thanks.
And next month, among other things, we should probably talk again about Brexit and how that might take shape and what is ahead for the European Union and for Britain, for that matter.
That would be one of my favorite subjects. We can't do it in an hour. We need at least 2 or 3 hours. If you can please arrange that.
Right. We'll see what we can do. Well, in the meantime,
lose every listener.
Professor Sear, I do appreciate you joining me today on the morning show for a lively conversation. These are lively times in which we live, and I'm always glad to have the opportunity to speak with you about them. Thank you so much for being here.
Well, thank you, Professor Berg. It's always a pleasure, at least for me, and I want to thank you again for your courtesy to Mark Miller.
We're glad to have you here. Tomorrow on the morning show, we speak with the executive director of the Kettle Moraine Land Trust, along with Nan Calvert. On Friday, you'll hear a conversation with Kyle Keitelson, who is author of an interesting book called Olympic Collision. It looks back at that unfortunate moment in the 1984 Olympics in the 3,000 meters race when the American favorite in that race, Mary Decker, was tripped up and fell in a collision on track with South African runner Zola Budd. It was one of the biggest stories of those Olympics. And the author looks back at that unfortunate event and the long and interesting careers and personal stories of the two runners involved and the aftermath of that in his fascinating book called Olympic Collision. Also, Jessica DeBoer will be here on Friday to talk about the next Fine Arts at First performance, which involves actually yours truly this Sunday afternoon. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived at WGTD.org. Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs.